He liked the very old romances best, and he hadn't ever encountered anything like this. There were no old men or old women. There were quite a few children in various bad, unhealthy conditions. Pot bellies, scabs on them, dirty, shocking. Didn't anyone properly feed them or clean them up? Men they passed gave them a funny salute with a raised finger. Ugly, contemptuous faces. Faces of all colors and mixed colors, and all dirty. Their clothing was a kind of joke of a uniform, and not worn with any style, just sloppy. They seemed to speak some strange kind of English, like they had oatmeal in their mouths. He knew he didn't talk really good English, not like university men such as Sir Robert, nor as good as Sir Johnny. But anybody could understand him when he talked, and he was trying to improve so that Colonel Ivan's English, which he helped him with, would be good. But these people didn't seem to care if the words even got out of their stinky mouths. Biddy almost bumped into Sir Johnny, who had stopped in front of a middle-aged man. What language was Sir Johnny using? Ah, Cyclo. Johnny was asking something, and the Brigante nodded and pointed over to the west and said something back in Cyclo. Biddy got it. Sir Johnny didn't want to know anything. He just wanted to see whether the Brigante spoke Cyclo. Clever. Where were they headed? Oh, toward that big lean-to that had a leopard-skin sort of flag on a pole in front of it. Biddy saw they had been following the prisoners who were still under guard, probably being taken to their chief. This was a pretty awful kind of people. They simply halted wherever they were, right in the path, and relieved themselves. Awful. Over there, a young man had thrown a girl down and they were... Yes, they were, fornicating right out in public. Biddy turned his head away and tried to purify his thoughts. But the direction he turned showed him a man making a child do something unspeakable. He began to feel a little ill and walked much closer to Sir Johnny's heels. These creatures were worse than animals, far worse. Biddy followed Sir Johnny into the lean-to. How the place stank. There was somebody sitting on a tree trunk they had built the lean-to over. The man was awfully fat and was yellowish with the yellow that Dr. McKendrick said was malaria. The folds of the man's body made deep seams of dirt. He had a funny cap on that must be made out of leather. It had a peak in front. There was something set on it. A woman's brooch? Some kind of stone? A diamond? The creature they had captured, Arf, was standing in front of the fat man. With a fist beat on his chest, Arf was making a report. What was he calling the fat man? General Snith? Wasn't Snit a Cyclo common name? Wasn't Smith the common English name? Terrible hard to tell with that oatmeal accent. The general was chewing on a haunch of something and didn't seem much impressed. Finally, the general spoke.
Did you get your supplies? The sulfur?
Well, no,
Arf said and tried to tell it all again.
Did you bring back your stiffs? The general said.
Stiffs? Stiffs? Oh, bodies.
This Captunk Arf seemed to get a bit scared and back up. The general hurled the haunch straight at him and hit him in the face with it.
How'd you expect ter eat, then? Screamed the general.
Eat? Stiffs? Bodies? Eat? Their own dead?
Then Biddy looked down at the thrown haunch that had ricocheted toward him.
It was a human arm.
Hurriedly, Biddy got out of there and got back of the lean-to and was very sick at his stomach. But Sir Johnny found him in a moment and put an arm around his shoulders and wiped his mouth with a bandana. He tried to get a Russian to take Biddy back to the plane, but Biddy wouldn't go. The place of a squire was with his knight, and Johnny might need his blast rifle among these horrible creatures. So they let him continue to follow. Sir Johnny looked into the lean-to in the edge of the trees and seemed very interested, and Biddy looked and saw a very old, very battered instruction machine like the pilots used to learn Cyclo, and this seemed to mean something to Sir Johnny. Who were they looking for now? The rain was coming down, and these people were racing around, and the blast rifle was very heavy and getting heavier. Oh, the coordinators. They found them in another lean-to,
a pair of young Scots. Wasn't one of them a McCandless from Inverness? Yes, he thought he recognized him. They sat there, soaking wet, even under cover, their bonnets like mops. They looked pretty white of face. Sir Johnny was trying to find out how they got here, and they were pointing to a pile of cable dropped by a plane. So Sir Johnny told them they'd better leave with them, and they were saying no. It was a council order to bring these people back to the compound in America, and even though the transports were overdue, they had supposed it was trouble for the council to be finding enough pilots for the lift. After a lot of argument about their duty on their side and their safety on Sir Johnny's side, they were persuaded to at least come to the plane where they could be given a food package and maybe some weapons. So they all pushed their way through this mob of people back to where the Russians held a defense perimeter and got into the plane. Sir Robert was there. He sat the two Scott coordinators down in one of the big cyclo bucket seats.
Was there a third one of you? Sir Robert wanted to know.
Well, yes, said McCandless. There was Allison, but a couple of days ago he fell in a river and some scaly beast got him.
Did you see this? Said Sir Robert.
Well, no, they hadn't seen it. The general had told them, and there were plenty of rivers and lots of scaly beasts. Sir Johnny was saying something now.
Did Allison talk cyclo?
He was in pilot training, said McCandless. The Federation needs its own pilots sometimes. I suppose he did.
Yes, he did, said the other Scot. He could talk some cyclo. They pulled him out of the class to come here. The order to lift these people out came very suddenly from the council, and we were short.
Sir Robert said,
Do you recall hearing him talk cyclo to these ruffians around here?
They thought for a while. The rain was drumming on the marine attack plane roof, and it was awfully hot.
Aye, said McCandless, finally. I heard him talking to one of the officers that was finding it remarkable he talked cyclo. They chatted away in it quite a while. I don't speak.
That's all we wanted to know, Sir Robert was saying.
He looked up at Sir Johnny meaningfully.
Interrogation. They wanted him for interrogation.
And Sir Johnny was nodding. Then Sir Robert pulled out something Biddy didn't know he had. A tam-o'-shanter with blood on it. He handed it to the two coordinators. They found some thread initials in it. Yes, it was Allison's. Where'd Sir Robert get it? Sir Robert blasted them very proper. He told them, and Biddy was shocked to learn that the Brigantes had sold Allison to the Cyclos. And the Cyclos must have wanted him for interrogation, and God help Allison now.
Sold Allison? A human being? To the monsters?
Neither Biddy nor the coordinators could get their wits around that. There was a dreadful row then. Sir Robert ordered the two coordinators to come along with them. The coordinator said this was their duty, to lift these people out. It was a council order. And Sir Robert thundered at them that he was the war chief of Scotland, and he damned well wasn't going to leave them here. The two coordinators tried to leave, and Sir Johnny and Sir Robert, using the cargo lashings Biddy hastily found, simply tied them up. They put them on top of the supplies at the rear of the plane. They withdrew their defense perimeter and took off, and Biddy was not surprised to hear one of the pilots ask permission to strafe these creatures from the air. Sir Robert said no. If they tried that, the creatures would just run under the trees. They weren't equipped to handle them right now, and they had other things to do. But if they'd done what they appeared to have done, they'd have a bloody feud on their filthy hands. Everybody was pretty upset about Allison. When they had taken off and were flying back to the compound, Biddy got to pondering those people down there. He leaned over to Sir Johnny and said,
Sir Johnny, how in all this rain can they be so dirty?
2. The big marine attack plane landed in the night near the branch mine. It was still deserted. The rain still came down. But there were quarreling sounds of animals over where the skirmish had been fought. The snarls and spits of angry leopards, the shattering barks of some other beast, the eerie cackling laughter of yet another predator. They were fighting over the bodies of the dead. The flatbed with the flying platform and blast mortar was where it had been prepared, just inside the hangar door. There was no sign that the other flatbed had returned in retreat.
It must still be following the convoy. Johnny looked through the deserted compound again. The lights were still on. The distant mine pumps still pounded away. Unless disturbed by some outside force, all such machinery would probably continue to run for decades. The planetary traffic printer was still sitting there spewing out paper that recorded current traffic. Johnny glanced through it.
McIver, can you please bring extra fuel to Moscow?
This is the traffic controller at Johannesburg. Are there any planes en route this way? If not, I can close Dune for the night. Isaac, please come in, Isaac. Listen, Isaac, were there any serviceable ore freighters left in the Grozny mine site? And can they be converted for passengers? Please let me know by morning. We're a wee bit shy of carriers right now. Lundy, we're cancelling you on the Tibet run. We need you and your co-pilot back here to help with an airlift. Please acknowledge, laddie.
Most of it in the pilot jargon of Cyclo. It struck Johnny that this stream of messages would give an attacker a pretty good idea of what areas were actively operating. It was almost a catalog of targets for Mark 32s. If the convoy got through and these Cyclos mounted an overall attack, they could take back the planet. He wondered whether he shouldn't put out a general call on this set and order a 72-hour radio silence. But no, the damage was done. These same messages were probably reeling out of the Lake Victoria mine site printer, too. And any transmission he made here might be picked up by the convoy, alerting it. Well, he would just have to succeed with the convoy, that was all. He walked back through the empty, echoing levels. The Cyclos, he noticed, had mainly stripped the place of armament. They were leaving no blast guns or portable weapons behind to fall into Brigante hands. Lucky they'd overlooked the mortars in their haste. The flatbed was out of the hangar now, waiting in the dark yard. Johnny shut the doors of the compound, no use letting in the leopards and elephants and snakes. He went back to the big plane and did a rapid review of the actions that were about to occur. He told them to fly in very low indeed, hugging ground, from way over to the east and come in behind the ambush point. He didn't want that plane on convoy tank screens. Then deploy along this ridge, this one here that flanked the road, and when the convoy was well into the ravine, give them a flanking fire. What if they turned around and started back? Well, he'd be there with a mortar on the flying platform to keep them from retreating. What? An incredulous Robert the Fox was saying. One mortar against tanks? That's impossible. The convoy would be able to get back into the forest, and they'd never get them out. Oh, you want this plane to take off and help block that? Well, that's all right. It is a battle plane.
Just try to roll the tanks and trucks over without exploding them, said Johnny. Use no radiation bullets, just blast gun force. Keep your weapons on broad blast, no flame, and stun. We don't want to kill them. As soon as they're all strung out along this ravine, block the road from the ambush. I'll block it from the rear. The rest of you flank it from the ridge. This battle plane is to help if they get loose and head back toward the forest, right?
Right.
A coordinator tried unsuccessfully to make up for the absence of the Russian coordinator, who was now with Ivan, and then said,
I'll make sure the Russian coordinator explains it when we get to the others. Oh, I've got it straight. I can tell them then.
Remember, said Johnny, there's a slim possibility that Allison is in that convoy, so keep your eye out for him, and if he gets away in the fight, don't shoot him.
Right.
And they'd get it explained to these Russians here when they caught up with Ivan.
Smooth, said Robert the Fox. Oh, so very smooth. The bulk of our force can't be briefed because the translator is elsewhere. What stupendous planning and coordination. I wish us luck. We will need it.
Johnny said, but we've got the Cyclos outnumbered.
What? Exclaimed Robert the Fox.
There's more than 100 of them, and only 50 or so of us.
That's what I mean, said Johnny. We've got them outnumbered 1/2 to 1. They got it, and some Russians more advanced in English than the rest explained the joke to the other Russians. They all laughed. The rain had been getting them down. They felt better. Johnny was getting down to the flatbed, where a Scot and four Russians, one of them a driver, waited, when a scurry in the plane drew his attention. It was Bitty McLeod, all set to go with him, draped around with equipment. This was something Johnny did not want. The coming battle was nothing to drag the boy into. But there was a problem, the boy's pride. Johnny thought fast. This was almost harder to solve than the tactics. Bitty's world was filled with the romances of 2,000 years ago, when knighthood was in flower, with flame-breathing dragons and pure knights and rescued fair damsels. Nothing wrong with that. He was a sweet little boy, and his greatest ambition was to grow up and become a man like Dunnell Dean or himself. Nothing wrong with that either. But his dreams risked bruising against the brutal realities of this world in which they fought, a world with its own brand of dragons. He would never live to become like Prince Dunnell Dean or Sir Johnny if he were not protected. But there was his pride, and it was showing now when he saw Johnny's paws, saw the search for an excuse to say no in Johnny's ice-blue eyes. Hurriedly, Johnny grabbed a mine radio from a seat and thrust it into the boy's hands. Johnny tapped the one in his own belt. He leaned very close to Biddy's ear and whispered, "I need a reliable contact on this plane who can tell me, after the battle is joined, if anything is going wrong. Don't use it until the first shot is fired. But if there's anything amiss after that, you tell me fast." He put a finger to his lips. Biddy was instantly bright, if a trifle conspiratorial. He nodded.
"Oh, yes, Sir Johnny."
And he faded back into the plane. Johnny hobbled down the squishy road to the flatbed. It was sitting there, lights stabbing through the sheets of rain. He checked his crew, got in, and nodded to the driver. The flatbed, with its flying mine platform and mortar, roared, drowning out the snarling fight over in the woods. They were off in a truck to do combat with tanks. 3. Brown Limper Staffer sat in his new palatial office and stared down at the offending object on the desk. He was revolted. Things had been moving well lately. The domed government building, some said it had been the state capitol building, had been partially restored, and even its dome painted white. The halls had been refinished. A chamber had been provided for council sessions, a very ideal chamber, with a high dais and bench on one end and wooden seats before it. Huge, upholstered cyclo-executive desks had been carted in to furnish separate offices for council members. They were a bit dwarfing to sit at, but if one put a man chair on a box behind them, they were all right. A hotel had been opened that provided living space for dignitaries and important visitors, and under the ministrations of a cook from Tibet, it was serving very passable meals on real plates. The tutelage he was getting while standing in the shadows of a post over at the compound at night was truly excellent. Utterly invaluable data about government. Tyrrell hardly deserved the extreme conditions of living in a cage. The cyclo had repented and was doing all he could to help. How misunderstood the cyclos were. The fruits of such learning were already showing up. It was taking a little time, and it required a considerable amount of political skill, but Tyrrell had traveled all over the universes as one of the most trusted executives of intergalactic mining, and the things he knew about governments and politics were far in excess of anything else available. Take this matter of having too numerous a council. The tribal chiefs from over the world resented having to come here and spend endless time wrangling in the chamber. They had their own tribal affairs to look after. They were also too numerous, 30 of them, to really get anything done. And it was almost with joy that they divided the world up into 5 continents with 1 representative from each. From an unwieldy throng of 30, the council had been reduced to a more easily handled 5. And when it was explained to them that their own tribal work was far more vital than this humdrum paper-shuffling at the council, and that the most competent men were needed at home, they had gladly pushed some cousins and such into the 5 continental seats. The 5-man council, of course, was a bit unwieldy, and it was in the process now of appointing a 2-man executive. With a little more work and the application of some invaluable tips Tyrrell had given him, Sometime in the coming weeks, Brown Limper would find himself the council representative with authority to act independently in the name of the council, assisted only by the council secretary, who, of course, did not need to have a vote, and would be required just to sign his name. It would be so much neater. The Scots had been a bit of trouble. They had protested Scotland being included with Europe, but it was shown that it always had been. This made their representative a German from a tribe in the Alps. Well, majority votes of the old council had handled that, and now there were no more of those accursed Scots around, challenging every sensible measure proposed by Brown Limper. The tribes were satisfied. They had been given title to all the lands about them, with absolute right to allocate them as they chose. They had each been given the exclusive ownership of the ancient cities and anything contained therein. This had made Brown Limper quite popular with the chiefs of most tribes, but not the Scots, of course. Nothing could please them. They had had the nerve to point out that this gave all property in the whole continent of America and everything in it to Brown Limper. But that was quashed by simply indicating that there were four tribes in America now: British Columbia, where two people had been found, the Sierra Nevada, where four people had been found, the little group of Indians to the south, and Brown Limper's. That they all now lived in Brown Limper's village had been quite beside the point. The selection of a capital had been another victory. For some reason, some tribes thought the world capital should be in their area. Some even thought it should shift about. But when it was pointed out how much trouble and expense it was to maintain a capital, and that Brown Limper's staffer, out of the goodness of his heart and with philanthropy as his only motive, would let his tribe pay all the costs, there was no further argument. The world capital had been decreed to be Denver, although its name one of these days would be changed to Staffer. The resolution of the old council, before it became only five, to establish a planetary bank, was what had started this trouble now before him. A Scot named McAdam had been called in, and he had advised them that the galactic credits they had would be meaningless to Earth people at this time. Instead, he proposed that he and a German now residing in Switzerland, a German who had an awful lot of dairy cows and home cheese factories, be granted a charter. They would issue currency to a tribe to the amount of land it had in actual productive use, and in return, they would charge a small percent. It was a good idea, for any tribe could only get more currency by getting more area into productive use. The currency was then backed by the Tribal Lands of Earth. The bank was to be called the Earth Planetary Bank, and the charter given it was quite broad and sweeping. With amazing speed, they had printed currency. The German had come in on it because he had a brother who had preserved the art of making wood-cutting blocks that printed on paper. They had found warehouses full of untouched currency paper in an old ruin called London, and hand presses in a town once called Zurich, while they were issuing currency. The notes only had one denomination, one Earth credit. Apparently, they had made one trial issue, and it didn't go. People didn't know what to do with it. They had been bartering with horses and such like, and they had to be taught what money was. So they had made a second issue. It was a specimen of this second issue that was lying on Brown Limper's desk and giving him much trouble. Not just trouble, but a revulsion so deep it was making him ill. The woodblock bill was very nicely printed. It said Earth Planetary Bank. It had a figure 1 in each corner. It had one credit spelled out in all the languages and calligraphy used by existing tribes. It had legal tender for all debts, private and public, on it, similarly repeated in the various tongues. It had exchangeable for one credit at the bank offices of Zurich and London or any branch of the Earth Planetary Bank. It had secured by the tribal lands of the tribes of Earth as attested in production. It had by charter of the Council of Earth, and it had the signatures of the two bank directors. All that was fine. But it had, squarely in the center of it, in a big oval, a portrait of Johnny Goodboy Tyler. They had copied a picture of him somebody had taken with a picto recorder. There he was in a buckskin hunting shirt, bareheaded, a silly look on his face somebody thought must be noble or something, and of all things, he had a blast gun in his hand. Worse, there was his name curled over the top of the picture, Johnny Good Boy Tyler. And even worse, on the scroll under the picture it said, Conqueror of the Cyclos.
Nauseating. Awful. But how could the bank make such a blunder?
Not 15 minutes ago, he had finished a conversation with McAdam on the radio. McAdam had explained that the first issue was not popular at all. So they had instantly gotten out this second issue. It seemed people might not know what money was, but they could comprehend Johnny Goodboy Tyler, and in some places they were not using it as money, but putting it up on their walls, even framing it. Yes, bundles of it now had gone to every tribe. No, they couldn't be recalled, for it would hurt the bank's credit. Brown Limper had tried to explain that this was totally against the council's intentions in chartering the bank. There had been a unanimous council resolution that there must be no more war. The resolution had meant war between tribes is hereby forbidden. But Brown Limper had seen that it was worded so as to include all war everywhere, including interplanetary. This banknote, he had explained, with all the logic he could bring to bear, was contrary to that anti-war resolution. They had this fellow brandishing a weapon, and they were actually inciting war in the future against the Cyclos, and who knew who else? McAdam had been sorry, and so had the German in Zurich. But they really didn't sound sorry. They had their charter, and if the Council wanted to ruin its own credit, it would be unfortunate if funds were cut off to America in the future, so the charter must stay valid and unchanged, and the bank must do what it saw fit to do in order to carry on its business. And it would be too bad when the World Court, now in planning, convened, if it had as its first suit a member of the bank against the council for breach of trust and corollary expenses. No, Brown Limper thought gloomily, they didn't sound sorry. He would take no more advice from council members about this. He would go down and get some while standing in the shadows of the post near the cage. But he didn't have any real hope. Johnny Good Boy Tyler, Conqueror of Cyclos. Brown Limper spat on the bill. He suddenly seized the bill and tore it frantically into little pieces. Then he threw the pieces around with angry gestures. After that, he gathered them all up again and, with a set, malevolent expression on his face, burned them. Then he pulverized the ashes with his fist. But somebody came in soon after and said with a delighted smile, "Have you seen the new banknote?" and waved one. Brown Limper rushed out of the room and found a place to vomit. Later, calmer, he determined that even though they were all against him, he would continue to do his very best for Earth. He would really get that Tyler. 4. The flatbed rumbled and jarred through the soaking wet night. The ground drive of these things was supposed to keep them floating 1 to 3 feet off the ground. But when the ground varied 8 to 10 feet from level every few feet, the effect was far from floating. It was bone-jarring. The teleportation-type drive sought to automatically adjust itself to the sensed ground distance. It corrected and recorrected, and the result was a whining, racing, dying, racing combination of rumbles and screeches that hurt the ears. No wheeled vehicle could have traveled this road at all. So gullied and rock-strewn a highway was fit only for wandering beasts, if that. The ore trucks that had traversed it for hundreds of years had worsened it rather than otherwise as they blew off the humus, the only thing that protected it from the gutting of the rain. Johnny was trying to get some sleep. He was dead tired. His left arm ached from constant use of the cane. His palm was calloused now, but even it had rubbed raw. 4 days of floundering through this forest, 4 days of constant sweating from the heat, 4 days of walking with a cane, and 4 nights full of insects had taken their toll. If he wanted to fight a battle with any degree of success, he had better get some sleep. The seat was, of course, huge. But it was not very cushioned, and when there weren't bumps and jolts, there were stops, like right now. He opened his eyes to look through the windscreen, the rumps of elephants. Tails twitching in the headlights, bedewed with rain, they were strolling along, used to these trucks,
and owning the road for themselves. Cyclo trucks had no car horns, but they had bull horns, and the Russian driver was using one now. He was telling those elephants to get off the road. He was repeating some word that sounded like Sukinsin, and Johnny divined it did not mean elephant. He went back to sleep, bullhorn and all. The next time he opened his eyes, a leopard was blocking the way. It had killed a mouse deer and was using the road for a dinner table. Johnny took it that the leopard did not like its meals interrupted. The fangs and glaring green orbs of the eyes indicated it was ready to take on any number of trucks. The bullhorn was going again. Somewhere they had changed drivers, and the Scot was at the controls. The leopard heard the Scot battle cry and leaped straight up and off the road and was gone. They passed over the dead mouse deer, once more on their way. A flatbed could do 80 on the flat. It was straining now to get 8. No wonder it took days to get from the branch compound to the main mine site. Testimony that cyclos didn't do it any faster lay in the little round-domed roadside houses that occurred every few miles. Johnny had stopped at the first one they came to. It was ideal for ambush, and even though he didn't think the cyclos would leave anybody behind, one should know what lay ahead. But it was just a dome, big enough for 4 or 5 cyclos to stretch out and rest, or wait for a repair truck, or have lunch. It was bare, a shelter that kept out wild animals and rain, nothing more. There was no sign of the other flatbed and its crew, so they were still following the convoy up ahead. Toward morning, Johnny woke to find the truck stopped. The lights were on. The rain was still pouring down. The driver was tapping Johnny's shoulder and pointing to the road ahead. Johnny sat up. Somebody had hacked some vines and made a sign on the road. It was an arrow. From the clean cuts, it appeared to have been done with a claymore or a bayonet. Cyclos would have shot the vines in two. So it was their own people. They'd left them a sign. It was pointing to a roadside rest hut. There was a clatter of weapons in the back as his crew made ready in case they dismounted. Johnny pulled the rain cape around him, checked his belt gun, and picked up a mine lamp and his cane. The rain drizzled down his neck as he got out. The only thing different about the mine hut was evidence of recent foot traffic in front of it and a door slightly ajar. Johnny pushed it open with his cane. The smell of human blood hit him. There was a scurry of something in there. Johnny drew his belt gun. But it was only a large rat that came charging out. The Scot was behind him with an assault rifle. 2 Russians were coming up. Johnny flooded the mine lamp light into the place. There was something lying against the far wall. He could not make it out for a moment and stepped forward to find he was walking in blood. He turned the mine lamp fully on the object. He went closer. It was hard to tell what it was beyond a mangle of shredded flesh. Then he saw a piece of cloth, part of a kilt. It was Allison. The Scot and the Russians stood petrified. A closer examination showed that every artery and major vein had been left unsevered. Careful cyclo claws had ripped away the flesh around them, slice by slice. The whole body had been shredded in such a fashion. It must have taken hours for him to die. They had left the throat and jaws until last, and much of them still remained. Interrogation cyclo style. There was something in the remains of the hand, a sharp-edged tool cyclos often carried in their pockets to clean motor points. A major artery on the inside of the leg was parted. Allison had effected his own death. He must have seized the tool from an unguarded pocket and finished himself. Could they have rescued him? Not in this forest and on this road, Johnny thought sadly. The cyclos must have started his torture at the compound and finished it here when they feared he might be dying. And they would have learned nothing of any help for their own convoy. Allison had not even known of their own expedition. Ah, but Allison possibly could have told them the numbers and disposition of bases the humans now had. And Allison had probably talked, for there are limits to human endurance. No, the remaining teeth were chipped with grinding. The jaws seemed to be frozen shut. Possibly Allison had not talked. But it didn't matter whether he had talked or not. The convoy was doomed.
It was doomed in the narrowed eyes of the Russians. It was doomed in the angry clench of the Scot's fist on a claymore. After a little, the Scot went out and got a tarp and laid it gently over the mess that had been Allison. The Scot said,
"We'll be back for you, laddie. With blood on our blades, never fear."
Johnny walked back out into the rain. It came to him suddenly that the Brigantes now had a blood feud with Scotland. The Cyclos? He was not too sure he wanted them alive now, and he had to make himself be very rational about it. 5. In the mid-morning twilight of the forest, they caught up with the other flatbed. It was the small beginning of the string of mishaps that were to dog them that day. Running in the dark, the other flatbed had come to a river, one of the many that wandered through this forest, on a more or less westerly course. Their own direction of travel had been to the east of south. The driver, possibly overly tired, had not slacked speed. These ground drives could run on water, if it were reasonably smooth, as the sensors under them could sense water as well as ground. A teleportation drive didn't rest the weight of a vehicle on the surface, but held it suspended. But the driver must have hit a bump on the bank and had an unlevel vehicle when he reached the water, and there it sat, nose submerged in the water, disabled. The crew was sitting there now on the flying mine platform, back in under the trees. They had flown it and the mortar off, and put themselves in a posture of defense. They were very happy to see Johnny. Crocodiles were all over the river bank in front of them, and a ring of the beasts were circling around the flying platform. Nobody had dared shoot for fear of pulling the convoy back on them. Johnny made room for the second platform on his own flatbed, and they flew theirs the short distance. The roars of the motors and the bellow and roar of the crocs were deafening, and Johnny was afraid they might be close enough to the convoy tail to attract attention. They left the half-submerged flatbed where it lay, and double-loaded with two platforms and two mortars, they crossed the river and continued their pursuit. Shortly after, the road got better, due possibly to a change of soil. They picked up speed. They had had about a 12 to 15 hour travel gap between the tail and themselves. But a convoy tends to be slower than a single vehicle, particularly in such rough terrain. They were traveling so fast, by early afternoon, that they did not see that it was getting lighter ahead. Abruptly, they burst out of the forest and onto a wide savanna. 3 miles ahead, there was the convoy tail. With a prayer they had not been seen, they did a U-turn and got back in the trees. Johnny directed them eastward within the thin border of the forest over very rough going. Then they stopped. The savanna before them was covered with grass and some shrub. Here and there, cactus-like plants dotted the wide expanse. Johnny got up on the cab to get a better look. Aha! The defile of the ambush was just ahead of the convoy. The lead tank was entering it now. That ravine seemed to be a cut through the southern shoulder of a range of mountains. Mountains. Up to the northeast, their crowns above the clouds, reared two peaks, enormously tall. Was that ice and snow? There was something else strange. Then Johnny had it. It wasn't raining. There was cloud. It was very hot and humid. There was not much sun, but it wasn't raining. The Russians were buzzing, looking at the convoy. It was impressive. Over 50 vehicles, most of them flatbeds loaded to the last pound with ammunition, fuel, and breathe gas, were crawling along like some enormous black snake. 5 tanks. The one in the lead was a Basher Bashar Way to Glory, a nearly impregnable armored vehicle. There was another tank in the middle and 3 tanks at the end. Now that their own motor was off, the roar of that convoy, even at this distance, was like thunder. If the ambush were in place, the ball would open when that whole convoy was in the defile and the mortar up front closed the road in front of them. Johnny turned to the Russian officer he had brought. The man hardly spoke any English at all, but with signs and a little relief map drawn in the dirt, Johnny got across what he wanted him to do. The southern side of the defile ended in a knoll. The right side of the defile was a steep hill, a cliff, in fact. If one of the flying platforms could just get behind that knoll and wait until all those vehicles were in the ravine, it could lob mortar shells into this end of the cliff and start an avalanche that would close the back door. The Russian got it. He and his crew took off in the flying mine platform, flew along inside the border of the trees, and vanished. Johnny watched the convoy intently. It was struggling along into the ravine. This was a set-piece battle, the kind he'd read of in old man books. When the whole convoy got into that defile, the ambush would avalanche the road closed in front of them, and the mortar he'd just sent would close the road behind them. They would have a soaring slope on their right and cliffs on their left. They wouldn't be able to turn around. And one had only to fly over them and tell them to surrender, and it would all be over, just like that. But set-piece battles seldom come off, as they were about to discover. They waited for the convoy to enter fully. There was just a momentary glimpse of the platform they had sent in as it settled into position. Perfect. Now all they had to do was wait for the last tank to enter. The head of the convoy was now out of Johnny's sight. Nearly all the convoy was in the ravine. Then, blam! The ambush mortar let go. Blam, blam, blam! But the last three tanks were not yet in the gap. Johnny dove for the console of the flying platform. His four-man crew scrambled up to hold on. The flying platform soared into the air, Johnny's fingers dancing on its rudimentary keyboard. He took it up 1,000 feet, south of the road and near the forest edge. He could see the head of the convoy now. A roaring avalanche was falling across the road in front of the Basher tank. He could see some Russians in a reserve group back of the ambush point. He spotted three Russians along the crest to the convoy's right, hundreds of feet above the vehicles. The Basher sought to climb the roadblock. Its guns would not elevate high enough. It backed and then charged the dust-geysering rock pile. The tank's nose lifted, and it began to fire. Blast after blast arced up from the tank. It must be firing explosive shells. They soared in a glowing curve up and dropped in the area where the ambush command post must be. But the mortar up there was still firing down. The last three tanks in the convoy were backing up. There was no way this end could be sealed. Johnny took the flying platform halfway between the convoy tail and the woods. The end tanks were now turning around. Let loose on the savannah, they would be very hard to handle even with planes. Yes, they were also Bashers. No, a plane couldn't handle them. At the end of the convoy, the tank charged the rock barrier again, probably to elevate its gun muscles. The tank in the center of the convoy was firing toward the ambush point, but could not fire up the steep slope to the crest. Johnny yelled to the Scot, "Start felling trees across their road!" The Scot got it and angled the mortar around. The Russians, holding on to the thin, tilting platform, began to drop mortar shells into the stubby barrel. They landed a shell beside a giant tree near the road back into the forest, and it began to topple. Mortar blast after mortar blast flashed at the forest edge. Trees began to fall amid towering columns of dust. Johnny was sighting the mortar in by tilting the platform. The three tanks saw the road back closing in front of them. They knew they could not get through and into the forest. They started to fan out on the savannah. Their guns opened up, trying to hit the flying platform. Johnny dodged their misused vehicle about. It had no armor. It was really just a flat plate. There was even hardly anything to hold on to. Dunnel Dean flashed down with the battle plane. He must have been up there thousands of feet and out of sight. Gouts of flame and dirt began to pound around the three Basher tanks. Suddenly, the convoy in the ravine began to close up. Evidently thinking it was moving again, the three tanks swerved and raced back to the convoy tail, mindful of their duty to protect it. They stubbed right onto the trail. Then they too halted. They were trying to fire up at the ambush point. They could not elevate to reach the crest of the slope to their left. The other flying platform opened up. Blast mortar shells crashed into the cliff behind the last tank. The rocks and dirt flashed into the air. An avalanche roared down and closed the back door. The lead Basher tried another charge at the rock slide, blocking their forward progress. Just at the instant its nose reared up, a mortar struck under it. The lead Basher flew up, rolled over in a back somersault, and lay upside down in the road, helpless. Johnny drew a deep breath. He was just about to tell Dunnel Dean to open up on a bullhorn and demand surrender, and was reaching for his belt mine radio to do so, when their fortunes reversed. Chapter 18, Section 6. Debacle. Cutting in through the chatter of cyclos in the convoy, but clearly heard because of its high pitch, the piping voice of Bitty said,
"There's nobody left here who speaks Russian, Sir Johnny. There's nobody to tell the Russians anything."
"What's happened?" barked Johnny.
"Sir Johnny, the tank shots wiped out the command post here. Sir Robert and Colonel Ivan and the coordinators are knocked out. I was under a tarpaulin pile. I would have told you sooner, but...
A whale.
I couldn't find my radio.
Then static and a babble of cyclo voices on the same wavelength. Johnny swung the flying platform north of the ravine and behind it, using it for protection. Below in the ravine, the jammed convoy clogged the road. It couldn't turn. It couldn't escape. But neither could they fire into all that ammunition and fuel and breathe gas without blowing the whole thing a mile high. There were only a few shots being fired down by the Russian soldiers. Only three of them were on the crest. The cyclos must have thought the crest was not held. There was a battery of commands on the mine radio. Suddenly, the cyclos unloaded from their vehicles, grabbing blast rifles. They lined up along the bottom of the slope, breathe gas masks in place. More cyclo commands. The line of huge bodies surged forward all along the slope bottom. It was 400 yards or more, very steep yards, up to the crest. They were going to storm the crest. But no real disaster yet. Dunnell Dean was in place up in the sky. It was very obvious that all he had to do was wait for those cyclos to get halfway up that slope and then set his guns on stun and knock them flat and unconscious. Then Biddy's voice again.
The Russians don't understand. They are rushing up to the crest.
Johnny lifted the platform a little higher to see. Biddy himself seemed confused. There was nothing wrong with the Russians manning that long top of the ravine's left side. In fact, they'd better. Yes, the reserve group of about 30 Russians were sprinting from in back of the crest, their assault rifles ready. The upcoming line of cyclos was about 100 yards up now, and still had 300 yards of very steep slope to climb. In just a few moments now, when those cyclos were far enough up from their trucks, Dunnell Dean could make a pass with guns and stun them flat. Biddy's voice.
These Russians are awful mad about Colonel Ivan. They think he's dead. They are not listening.
Johnny slammed the flying platform down behind the Russians and jumped off. He started toward the cliff. The Russians had reached it. Several were firing down at the cyclos.
Hold off! Johnny yelled at them. That plane will knock them down.
Not one Russian face turned in his direction. He looked wildly about for one of their officers. He saw one. But the man was yelling something down the slope at the cyclos and firing a pistol at them. The officer roared something at his men. They rose up. Good Lord. They were going to charge. Before Dunnell Dean could make his firing pass, the downslope was loaded with charging, shouting Russians. They were angry, berserk. They stopped, fired, ran, stopped, fired. The slope was a roaring sheet of flame going both up and down. The cyclos tried to stem this avalanche of ferocity. Assault rifles were hammering and flaming. Blast guns were roaring. Dunnell Dean, unable to shoot without killing Russians, hung helplessly in despair. One pass and those cyclos would be knocked into unconsciousness. The Russians were in among the cyclos, firing ceaselessly. The remaining cyclos tried to run back to their vehicles. The Russians were right on top of them. Huge bodies went tumbling down the slope. Isolated groups tried to stand their ground. Assault rifles racketed into solid sheets of sound. Then, one last cyclo almost made it to the cab of a truck. A Russian knelt, sighted, and cut him in two. A cheer went up from the Russians. The slope went quiet. Johnny surveyed the ruin. Over 100 cyclo bodies. 3 dead Russians. Smoke drifting up from clothing that still burned. Disaster. They had been there to capture cyclos. Johnny kept plunging down the slope. He found the Russian officer standing there, obviously intending to shoot any cyclo that twitched.
Find some alive, Johnny shouted at him. Don't finish off the wounded. Find some alive.
The Russian looked at him with battle-glazed eyes. Seeing it was Johnny, he began to unwind a bit. He fished about for some English.
That show cyclo. They kill Colonel.
Johnny finally got it across that he wanted them to find any live ones. Neither the officers nor the rest of the Russians thought this very sensible. They did finally understand it. They went poking among the recumbent cyclos to find any that were still breathing, a fact that could be determined by a flutter of a breathe mask valve. They finally located about four that were shot up, but still alive. They couldn't move the 1,000-pound bodies very much, but they straightened them out. McKendrick put in an appearance, walking, half-sliding, down the slope. He looked at the four and shook his head.
Maybe. I don't know much about cycloanatomy, but I can stop that green blood oozing out.
One of them had a different tunic from the rest. An engineer? Do all you can, he told McKendrick, and hobbled up the slope toward the ambush point. Biddy was beckoning to him from the top of a rock, then scrambled down and vanished behind it. Johnny came up and surveyed the scene. The command post they had chosen was a hollow in the rocks, and it was a mess. The basher tank had scored a hit just above it. The gear was all smashed up. Their radio was in bits. Biddy was kneeling beside Sir Robert, lifting his head. The old veteran's eyes were blinking. He was coming too. They were stunned with concussion. Some blood was coming out of their ears and noses. Johnny walked closer. Probably some broken fingers, lots of bruises. None of it serious. With water from a canteen on a bandana, he went about the work of bringing them around. Robert the Fox, Colonel Ivan, two coordinators, and a Scott radio man. Johnny clambered up on a rock and looked down the defile. The convoy was all there. Nothing had blown up, so the Russians must have been using plain, not radioactive, slugs. But they hadn't been after the material. They'd been after live cyclos. Three Russians and Angus were getting the lead basher tank open, a trick to do, for it was upside down, which sealed its hatches. Angus got a side port open with a torch. The Russians looked in. Johnny cupped his hands.
Any alive in there?
Angus saw him up there, looked into the tank, and back up to Johnny. Angus shook his head negatively. He called back,
Crushed and suffocated.
Sir Robert had made his way up to Johnny, very shaky and white of face. Johnny looked at him. Sir Robert started to speak, and Johnny joined him in chorus.
The best planned raid in history.
7. It took them 3 hard-working days to clean up the mess and occupy the Lake Victoria mine site. The ore road had gone south to skirt the mountain ranges and turned back north to the mine site itself. In full view, when the overcast parted, to the northwest of the mine site were the Mountains of the Moon. It was a long range that contained at least 7 peaks up to 16,000 feet high. Right here on the equator, in all this heat and humidity, one didn't look for snow and ice, but there it was atop those peaks. There were even glaciers up there. Now and then the towering tops were briefly visible, blazingly white. At one time, this range had been the border between 2 or 3 countries of ancient times. At the period of the cyclo invasion, or perhaps before, the passes had been mined with nuclear tactical weapons. Needless to say, close as the mountains were to the mine site, the cyclos never went there. There were several small tribes in the Mountains of the Moon, brown and black, and even some whites remaining. They were often starved, despite the teeming forests and savannas full of game below them, and although they could come down now, long tradition kept them from approaching the mine site. An ancient dam the man map said was the Owens Falls Dam provided power for the mine site, power so plentiful that the cyclos just left all lights blazing. This was an extensive mine site with 7 underground levels and many branches working for tungsten and cobalt, and it was plentifully supplied with machinery and equipment. But McArdle, in his original raid, had blown up their fuel and ammunition plant and all their dumps. The 4 wounded cyclos were in a sealed-off section of the dormitory, and breathe gas was pumping into it. McKendrick did not have much hope for them, but he was working on it. The problem of the other bodies they had solved. There was no morgue, and fighting time in this equatorial heat, they had hastily gotten forklifts and ore freighters from the mine site and lofted the cyclo bodies up through the clouds to the freezing temperatures and crusted ice and snow of a mountain peak once called, the man map said, Elgon. They were up there now, 97 bodies, around 1,000 pounds each, neatly laid out in the frigid zone.
"We may have no diplomas," Donald Dean had said when they finished, "but it would seem we are pretty good cyclo undertakers."
And then he looked down from the dizzy altitude to the plains below and added,
"Or is it overtakers?"
The Scots scorned his joke. It was so terrible. They had opened up the road with blade scrapers and righted the Basher tank with a crane and driven the vehicles the rest of the way to the mine site. Despite company regulations, they stored the fuel, ammunition, and breathe gas underground out of the way of attack. They were experts in attacking such dumps. Thor had come back to help them. He said some of the people in the tribes had seen the flashes of the battle, and when they heard the last cyclos were mopped up, they had named the day the Tyler Battle Day. Thor had flown a hunting party down to the savannah, and they had come back with game, and there had been a lot of feasting and dancing.
"It is sometimes very gratifying, Johnny, to be taken for you. But I had to disappear during the battle. You can't be in two places at once."
Thor had spotted the convoy exit from the forest and had discreetly stood by at 200,000 feet to assist if needed. He had full picto-recorder discs of the whole battle and was surprised that nobody wanted to see them. Tired, glad to be out of the rain, they sat around in the huge chairs of the Cyclo Recreation Hall. Johnny was looking through the pilot traffic that still spewed out on the printer. Nothing unusual. He threw it down.
"We better get to work," said Johnny.
They had been working. What did you call what they'd been doing, if not working? Robert the Fox shook his head. Angus looked at his hands, bruised by wielding heavy torches and twisting open oversized locks. Dunnell Dean just stared and thought of the flight hours ferrying dead cyclos to the snow. Colonel Ivan whispered back of a bandaged hand to the coordinator, who then told him what Johnny had said, and he looked back frowning. Hadn't his people been killing every cyclo in sight and driving trucks and cleaning a mine site and doing everything else?
"Well," said Johnny, "I hate to have to tell you that we aren't here to do all that."
"All right. But then what?"
"We are here," said Johnny, "to find out why the Chamko brothers committed suicide."
"The devil with the Chamkos. They were just cyclos, and they tried to kill Johnny." So Johnny made a speech. He paused now and then to let the coordinator catch up for the Russians present. He told them that they did not know whether or not Cyclo was still there as a functioning planet. He told them about the galactic banknote and all the races listed on it, and he remembered he had one and passed it around. They realized what he was saying. Earth was wide open to counterattack. If the Cyclo planet were still there, it would eventually counterattack with new gas drones. And these other races possibly had means of reaching Earth swiftly. And when they found there were no Cyclo defenses here, they could slaughter the place if they had a mind to. The only way to find out was to rebuild the teleportation shipment rig and get it cracking. But the Cyclos put on the project had attacked him when he questioned them on that subject. They got it. They also got the fact that no other group or organization was working to handle these problems or the defenses of the planet. "Which elects us," Johnny said. They agreed. "So, Angus, I want you to set up that machine they said you used on me to feel that steel splinter, and we're going to set it up and start looking in cyclo heads. If we find something, and if one of those cyclos that are still alive can be operated on, we will have somebody we can make rebuild the teleportation rig, and we're in. We can cast picto-recorders out and look at Cyclo, and we can look at these other civilizations, and then we'll know where we are. Right now, we're listing in the cloud layers with no direction but down. Without knowing, I think we're dead men."
"We have all the mathematics and texts on teleportation," said Angus. "I've seen them, man. I've even held them in my hands."
"But you haven't made any sense out of them," said Johnny. "I tried for weeks to unravel them.
I'm no mathematician, but there's something wrong with those mathematics. They just don't work out. So we need a cyclo who won't commit suicide if we ask him.
Tell me, Johnny, said Dr. McKendrick. I see no evidence of anything in their heads. You can't x-ray or whatever you